I watch television and I hear about this guy, Bernie Sanders, and I say, that's an interesting guy. I'd love to meet him. Not me. That's kind of what I feel. I thought that we had a message that would resonate with the American people, but the truth is it's resonating a lot faster than I thought it would. And one of the problems we're having now is putting together the political infrastructure to kind of channel all of that support into constructive and effective political action. So that's where we are right now.
During the primary, you get to fall in love. However, during the election, you have to fall in line. If the reason you're going for a particular candidate is because you like that candidate's ideas, then it would only stand to reason that in the general election, you're going to get behind the party. You're going to fall in line. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 146. And I'm very happy to be here with you, as usual, for what I like to see as my way of venting after an entire week of reading about this stuff, watching news, making audio clips, prepping the show, all the things that I do to make this happen. This is me venting, and this is you getting to hear about. I become the filter of sorts. I assemble the show, I cut out the crap, and I give you what you need to know about what's happening in politics. Thank you so much for being here. What's happening right now, it seems to me that it happens in every election cycle, and so it is natural. Bernie and Hillary. So what we're looking at is I will hear Bernie people say, and it stresses me out, I will hear Bernie people say, if he doesn't get it, then I'm not going to vote. Or I'm going to vote for a third party candidate, which in effect means that you're going to vote for the Republican. Sorry, because the two party system, as imperfect as it is the way it is because that's the way that you get the most amount of people for a certain candidate. If we have two parties, you got to get 51% of the vote to win. If we have three parties, well, then you only need 34%. And if you have four parties, well, then you only need 26%. And the number gets smaller and smaller the more that you have. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't challenge the parties that are out there. We should. One of my daughters said to me yesterday, she says, I'm afraid of government a little bit. And I said, oh, okay. Well, what to you, what is government? Do you know what government is? And she says, well, not really. It's just a big thing. I said, it's you. Government is you. So when you hear people say that they're afraid of the government, they're essentially afraid of themselves. When we argue against government, when we argue for smaller government, what we're saying is that you and I should have less power. You and I should have less say. When we talk about the candidates, these people are there because of us. And essentially, they're supposed to be there for us. But what has happened over time is they are less and less responsive to us. And that is because so much of our election process, which is incredibly long, and incredibly expensive, this just leads to those candidates not responding to us anymore. The Bernie-Hillary thing upsets me a lot. First of all, there is a local progressive talk show host, wonderful gentleman named Carl Wolfson, used to be on KPOJ, listened to him on KPOJ, and I now listen to him on KXRY. He has decided to quit his radio show, and his reason is that he is sick of the Bernie supporters. He sees the Bernie supporters as indignant, rude, sometimes absolutely outright insulting. And to a degree, I understand his reasoning. I've gone online, I have seen the feeds, and I have seen people call him a fake progressive and all sorts of terrible things. And somebody even went as far as to take feces and write, you know, something bad about Hillary on his car. Because he's a Hillary supporter. To write something bad about Hillary on his car in feces. When I heard that this happened, when I saw the comments online, I said, okay, our discourse has gotten incredibly poisonous. But when I look at what Mr. Wolfson posts, although he's not being as rude or awful or as indignant, he's certainly not helping the situation either. In one particular post, I saw that he wrote that if we elect Bernie Sanders, if we nominate Bernie Sanders, he will not win the election and we are committing political suicide. Now, I think it's awful that somebody would say something so terrible to him, to call him a fake progressive and all the rest, but I also don't think you're helping the situation by using words like political suicide. We do need to take a measured approach to the election, to the way we conduct these things. And this process that we're going through, we go through this process every 4 years, essentially, unless the guy that's currently in office is running for office again. And everybody gets behind their candidate in the process. And there's nothing wrong with that. Mr. Wolfson also shares articles online saying, look at this. Look, this article is saying what I'm saying. This article is saying what I'm saying. So therefore, I must be right. This article is saying what I said months ago. So therefore, I must be right. Well, you don't get to engage in confirmation bias. You don't get to only seek out the information that confirms what you believe. You also have to take a look around. Senator Sanders was at 4% when he entered the race in Iowa. 4%. And he just came out neck and neck, a razor thin margin between him and Hillary in Iowa. 49.9% for her, 49.6% for him. Nationally, she has been 50, 60, 70 points ahead of him. That lead has been erased. They're now running neck and neck. The thing about elections is it's based on who turns out. There are a lot of first-time caucus goers. There are a lot of people who haven't been involved in the process before. A lot of people who felt disenfranchised by the process now feel like there is somebody out there that is speaking to them, for them, and will work for them, and he is the only guy in the race that does not have a super PAC. Because as it's been pointed out, if you have a super PAC, you're not being elected, you're being purchased. And for all of Hillary's good ideas, she has a super PAC. If people turn out, he will win. But, now let's say Hillary gets the nomination, and that's okay, I am going to vote for Hillary. So saying, I am not going to vote for her, I will go for a third party candidate, I will vote for a Republican, I will stay home, that's dumb. And it's dangerous because the big prize for the Republicans with the election of George W. Bush in 2000, as contested as it was, the big prize that they got out of that election was not just all the awful things that he did, both economically and with foreign policy. They got the Supreme Court, and they got the Supreme Court in a big way. He got two nominees. He made one of his lawyers in the Bush v. Gore case, which was John Roberts. He made that guy, he didn't just put him on the Supreme Court, he made him the head of the Supreme Court. And now we've gotten a lot of terrible decisions that have come out of that court, not the least of which brings us to our current election system, which is brought to us by Citizens United, which allows for our elections, our politicians, to be purchased in a bigger way than it ever has before. And now we have a system that definitely is less, it doesn't just seem less responsive to us. It is less responsive to us because it's being bought and people are sick of it. So even on the right, they are revolting against their candidates. Donald Trump is number one. They say Donald Trump can't be bought. He can't be bought. He himself is a billionaire. So they revolt on the conservative side and they run a billionaire for, of course they do. Of course they do. And that's fine. They're not dumb people. They're just upset by the way things are going. Even though they got their candidate, even though they got the Supreme Court they wanted, they are upset by the way things are going because, yes, it's less responsive to them. For progressives, it has always been less responsive to them. And Bernie speaks to them in a big way. And we do have two good candidates. We have an embarrassment of riches. Hillary is a good nominee. Bernie would be a good nominee. They're both great candidates. She is a real progressive. He is a real progressive. We're having a fight about that currently right now that I disagree with. So we'll get to that in another show. But the thing that upsets me the most, and I say this as a Bernie supporter, the thing that upsets me the most about the way Hillary Clinton is being talked about right now is the sexism. The Google Trends after a recent debate on MSNBC went like this. The trending topics about her were, how old is she? How much does she weigh? Things of that nature. Not her and her policies. Those are the questions. And then for Bernie, you know, who is Bernie? Where's he speaking next? You know, nobody asked what Bernie Sanders weighs. There's another school of thought that bothers me, and it is this. We need a woman president. It is time for a woman president. Fine, if it's time for a woman president, then why not Palin? Why not Fiorina? Why not Michelle Bachmann? And it is because ideas matter. Or there's this. We can't have a woman president because nobody will respect us. Or, I mean, if you're saying I'm going to vote for her because she's a woman, it's a bad idea. If you're saying I'm not going to vote for her because she's a woman, none of that should matter. The only thing that should matter are the ideas. And the ideas that she's promoting right now are good ideas. Yes, her past can be a little shady. But even Senator Sanders has votes that he's not very proud of. They're few and far between, much fewer than with Secretary Clinton, but they're out there. But really, we've got two good candidates. And the fighting? Stop. You need to stop. Listen, Democrats, if you don't stop fighting, no White House for you. Do you hear me? I will pull this car over, and we will sit here on the side of the road, and we will watch the world go by. Stop fighting with one another. It's stupid. And all of the infighting, we lose. So, we are in the primary. And this is the way primaries go. I remember it also being very contentious in 2008. And Hillary, who that year also really expected that she was going to be the nominee, did not expect that she was going to get edged out by Senator Obama, eventually got edged out, eventually got beat. We know who Hillary Clinton is. She has been in the national spotlight for a long time, and that has both helped her and hurt her. But Bernie Sanders, the world is now learning who Bernie Sanders is. Many Americans are now learning who Bernie Sanders is, and it's weird to me. When John Kerry decided to run for president, I didn't know a lot about John Kerry, and I had to do a bunch of research. You know, when Gore ran for, even though he's vice president, I really didn't know that much about him. Most of the candidates, when they decide to run, I don't generally know a lot about who they are. And then I have to go through the process that a lot of folks are going through the process of with Senator Sanders right now. And that's learning who the candidate is. But Bernie, Bernard Sanders, independent Democratic socialist from Vermont, I know who he is. Because I have been listening to him on Tom Hartman's show for 10 plus years, taking calls, unfiltered calls from anybody with any question. And he would talk directly to people. He would go on every Friday for an hour and take whatever question you had. Now, you're not allowed to get on the phone and be abusive or be drunk or use bad language or anything like that. But you can ask him anything you want. And I heard some supporters call up and ask questions. And I heard some of his would-be detractors call up and ask him questions. So now everybody's learning who the senator is. And let me point this out. No matter who gets the nomination, and it's down to two now, it's only Bernie and Hillary, so it's going to be one of them. No matter who gets the nomination, it is 10 times better than anything that the conservatives are pushing. So let's talk. Democratic socialism. I identify as a democratic socialist. That's the party that I belong to. It's a very small party in America, but I think if most people knew what it was, most people would also belong to that as well. Most people simply pick out Democrat or Republican, a progressive or conservative, and that's fine as well. My position is much more nuanced. So, democratic socialism, and it goes like this in a nutshell, simply put, the commons belong to the people. That's big government. The commons belong to the people. You and I, fire departments, police departments, roads, bridges, healthcare as a right. Because yes, that is a common. It's a system that we all use. And so it should be a right. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to have government-run hospitals. It simply means if we have a single-payer system, it will lower the cost and cover everybody. And yes, healthcare should be a right. To argue that guns should be a right and healthcare should not is just insane to me. And I'm pretty sure that that's not what Jesus would want. But ask a conservative, and Jesus wants you to own guns, but he doesn't want you to have affordable healthcare. The National Review, which is a conservative paper that's been around for some time, was pushing the idea that Bernie Sanders is running on a national socialist platform. In a post in the National Review Online, editor Kevin Williamson claimed that Sanders' political views equate to national socialism, even as he acknowledged that Sanders, who is of Jewish heritage, national socialism, he's trying to say national socialism more in the vein of a Nazi Germany, which is pretty insane because Senator Sanders is Jewish. Senator Sanders lost family in the Holocaust. And so to say that he is running as a national socialist akin to the Nazis is pretty embarrassing. This from Media Matters. In the Bernieverse, there's a whole lot of nationalism mixed up with socialism. Bernie is, in fact, leading a national socialist movement, which is queasy and uncomfortable thing to write about a man who is the son of Jewish immigrants from Poland whose family were murdered in the Holocaust, and there is no other way to characterize his views and politics.
It is time we had democratic socialism for working families, not just for Wall Street, billionaires, and large corporations. Democratic socialism means that we must create an economy that works for all, not just the very wealthy. Public education must today allow every person in this country the right to go to a public college or university tuition free. Democratic socialism means that our government does everything it can to create a full employment economy, that we must raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Democratic socialism to me means that we have government policy which does not allow the fossil fuel industry to destroy our environment and our planet, that in a democratic, civilized society, the wealthiest people and the largest corporations must pay their fair share of taxes. It means that health care should be a right of all people, not a privilege. We need to develop a political movement which once again is prepared to take on and defeat a ruling class whose greed is destroying our nation.
It does not mean Nazism. It does not mean Hitlerism. It does not mean that everybody is going to die in Bernie Sanders' ovens. How can you say that about whose family survived the Holocaust? The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. That is a quote from John Kenneth Galbraith, who is a famed economist. There's an article over at Tom Dispatch titled, America Could Have Been One Giant Sweden. Instead, it looks like the Soviet Union. So the idea here is what is known as convergence theory. And that is the trajectory that your society, your country, will eventually go to. Okay, so from the article, back in the 60s and 70s, influential thinkers like John Kenneth Galbraith predicted that the United States and the Soviet Union would converge at some point in the future, with the market tempered by planning and planning invigorated by the market. Like any good academic notion, it didn't come to pass. the United States veered off in the direction of Reaganomics and the Soviet Union eventually collapsed. The reason it's titled One Giant Sweden is because their trajectory took them to a place where they now have a democratic socialist country, which is to say they have a national healthcare system. They have higher wages. They don't have this race to the bottom, a system that only helps rich people like we have here. Take Hungary, a member of the European Union and a key post-communist adherent to liberalism, has been heading off in an altogether different direction since its ruling Fidesz party took over in 2010. Last July, its Prime Minister Viktor Orban declared that he no longer looks to the West, that's us, for guidance. To survive in an ever more competitive global economy, Orban is seeking inspiration from various hybrid powers, the other un-Swedens of our planet, Turkey, Singapore, and both Russia and China, touting the renationalization of former state assets and stricter controls on foreign investment. He has promised to remake Hungary into an illiberal state. Remember that. That's going to come up again. That both challenges laissez-faire principles and concentrates power in the leader and his party. So look at it like this. There's a part of the article here called Bats Do It, Whales Do It. Bats and whales don't look at all alike, but they operate in similarly dark environments. Bats hunt at night while whales navigate the murk of the ocean. Because neither animal can rely on visual clues, they have developed the ability to what is called echolocate, to use, that is, sound waves to find their way around. This clever strategy is an example of convergent evolution, adaptation by different creatures to similar environmental conditions. Some social scientists in the Cold War period looked at communism and capitalism in much the same way evolutionary biologists view the bat and the whale. Both systems, while structurally different, were struggling to adapt to the same environmental factors, the forces of modernity, of technological development, of growing bureaucratization. Would, it was then believed, push both systems in the same evolutionary direction. Convergence theory officially debuted in 1961 with a short but influential article by Jan Tinbergen, Communism and Capitalism. The Dutch economist argued would learn to overcome internal problems by borrowing from each other. More contact between the two foes would lead to a virtuous circle of more sharing and greater convergence. Further exposure came with John Kenneth Galbraith's 1967 bestseller, The New Industrial State. From there, the concept spread beyond the economics profession and the transatlantic alliance. So what we have right now is a little bit of what's referred to as the welfare state. And that sounds terrible because that makes it sound like everybody's on welfare, but that's not what it is. What we have is a system that has a way to take care of everybody, or ideally it should. We've had the welfare state for a while, but now that some folks have seen unprecedented success, they would very much like to strip that part of the system out that helps other people lift up. So the welfare state was great for them. It was very helpful for them. But now that they are doing well, they would like to kick the ladder out for everybody else. And they say, hey, don't worry about it. You can still get to the top of the building even if we take away the ladder. The mountain that we are now on, you can get to the top of that mountain too, even if we cut your legs off. This isn't a rich people are evil argument. That's not what it is. I think that a lot of wealthy folks, certainly a lot of the ones that get politically involved, are insecure. Their wealth, perhaps, makes them insecure. They want to see themselves do well, but they don't want to see anyone else do well. So there's an article over at Raw Story by David Edwards, and it's titled, A Member of the 1% Shocks Reddit. I'm voting for Bernie Sanders, and here's why. So we talk about the 1%, the top 1%, right? The guys that own everything, the guys that control our political system, and they go overwhelmingly for conservatives, for Republicans. So this gentleman gets on Reddit and says, I am a member of the 1%, but I am voting for Bernie Sanders, and here is why. From the article, a self-described member of the 1% shocked the Reddit community with an explanation why he was voting for the presidential candidate who will make his taxes higher. In a wildly popular Reddit post, a user named Thundered11 announced, "I'm a member of the 1% and I'm voting for Bernie Sanders." The user, who described himself as a white male in his 30s, said that he grew up fairly poor and then started a successful consulting firm after nearly a decade in the military, earning him a membership to the 1%. He argued that Sanders' plan to raise taxes on the wealthy was the right way to address income inequality. After all the write-offs, business expenses, mortgage deductions, etc., he says, "My taxable income is less than half of my gross income. Add in my capital gains earning in the super low tax rate. Even though my gross income is well over the top bracket, my effective tax rate is around somewhere around 17 to 18% every year. And it could actually be quite a bit lower if I actually decided to put in effort into legal tax avoidance strategies." He says, "This gives me a slightly lower effective tax rate than my housekeeper." And according to the business owner, returning to the higher 90% rate would take his effective tax rate to 33% of an effective 18%. So please don't let the 91% top tax bracket fool you, he says. Let me talk with you about, real quick, the top marginal tax rate of 91%, which is what it was under Eisenhower. Top marginal rate. Listen, top marginal rate. Over on Fox News, I hear them say, "If he raises my taxes to 91%, and there is where the confusion is created. He's not going to raise everyone's taxes to 91%. That would be stupid. But what it means is after you get above a certain threshold, you'll pay the 91% tax rate. Having a tax rate that high is not for the purposes of collecting more money for the government. What it is supposed to do, though, is it is there to regulate behavior. So let's take, I think the number back during Eisenhower's day was 3 million. Anything over 3 million, you paid an effective 91% tax rate. So let's go a little higher for inflation. Let's say 10 million. Let's say everything you make over $10 million, rather than paying a 15 or 20% tax rate on, which they go, "Hey, you know what? That's not that bad. I will pay myself $50, $80, $90, $100 million a year," which you do not need. Nobody needs. I get it. You have a mansion. You have an island. You need... No, okay, I get it. Fine. Stop. Stop the whining. Stop. Easy. Easy now. Okay, let me finish. So let's say Bernie Sanders comes in and he gets the Congress that he wants and they implement a top marginal tax rate of 91% on everything over $10 million. That means you, the guy with the yacht and with the island and with, you know, the 30 naked women around here, whatever you do, you can pay yourself $10 million a year. But everything over that, you'll pay a massive tax rate. So you know what you're better to do is you're better to put that money into your company, maybe updating the equipment, maybe paying your employees more, maybe expanding your business. Put that money back into your business and then it will not be taxed at that incredibly high rate. It's not meant to get more money for the government. It's meant to make you put that money back into the economy because the economy doesn't do better when you're hoarding it. Don't let the top 91% tax bracket rate fool you. The rich will still be plenty rich. This is back from the article. My standard of living will change 0%, he says. I will still drive an expensive car and go on nice vacations and pay my employees and buy the same things that I have always bought. He predicted that doubling the minimum wage would be wonderful for business. His words. Feel free to look up all the studies of how very little product prices would have to increase to support doubling the minimum wage and still maintain profit margins. It's laughable, he wrote. I pay every one of my employees above market rates, cutting into my own profit margins, and here's the result. I have a cult following. So what would a Bernie Sanders presidency look like? Or more importantly, what would the world look like, or what would the United States look like post-Bernie Sanders presidency? Now this, pose to him that very question.
It looks like a nation in which government works for all of our people, and is not just beholden to corporate America and wealthy campaign contributors. It looks like an America in which we join the rest of the industrialized world and guarantee health care to all people as a right. We're the only major country that doesn't do that. It looks like an America in which we have overturned this disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, which is undermining American democracy and creating a very corrupt campaign finance system which allows the Koch brothers and other billionaires to literally buy elections. We will have overturned that. It will look like an America where we are leading the world involving our young people and our engineers and our scientists working with China and Russia and India and other countries in turning back and combating climate change. It will look like an America in which we have made fundamental improvements in combating institutional racism and in reforming our very broken criminal justice system. So there's a lot to be talked about. Those are some of the issues that Bernie Sanders' America, I think, would look like.
So Bernie has shown that he can get the progressive support. That's not a problem. In his state of Vermont, he has regularly gotten about 20% of the Republican vote.
In Vermont, three candidates are tied for first place for the Republican nomination for president, and those three candidates are Ben Carson, Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders. This is the Republican vote. I mean, among Democratic voters in his home state, Bernie Sanders has a 51-point lead over Hillary Clinton. But he's in first place on the Republican side, too. He's at least tied for first on the Republican side.
So he's shown that he can get progressive votes. He's shown that he can get Republican votes. So the next thing that should be jumping on the Bernie bandwagon, and I call it that not as a slight, but as a just describing us in aggregate. Let's all get on it. And not just because everybody's doing it, but because it's a good idea. The next group that should be joining the revolution should be libertarians. There's an excellent article written by a gentleman named Edwin Lingar over at Salon. And he says why the title of the article is Why Libertarians Should Love Bernie. The subheadline, most self-identifying libertarians actually subscribe to a bankrupt ideology. What if they all opened their eyes? And he says, I was a libertarian-leaning Republican. I was a delegate for Ron Paul in 2008. He says, at the Nevada State Convention, he says, the experience was the beginning of the end of my affiliation with simplistic libertarian blather and GOP politics altogether. But Paul's rise was driven by the same frustration and anger that is now propelling Senator Sanders. And if I may add, not this isn't a part of the article, this is also the same anger that's propelling Donald Trump. For too long, the anger and passion has been driven by Tea Party types and libertarians. Their solution seems to be throwing more gasoline on a trailer park fire. Inequality? Cut taxes for the wealthy and implement a flat tax. Poverty? Eliminate the social safety net and cut food stamps. The current problem with politics, the economy, and culture comes from treating human beings like just another business asset to be exploited or replaced. We say a person's value in a person's value is what the market will bear. And if the market has no use for a particular human, he or she has no inherent worth. That's pretty sick. Should we just starve them all to death? For the radical right, the answer is enthusiastically, absolutely. And if all else fails, just deport them. I listened to Donald Trump talk, still quoted from the article here. He says what I just wrote about sarcasm in the face, he says what I just wrote without sarcasm or a trace of humanity. He and other politicians agree with Sanders' assessment of reality, but their solutions could not be more different. Corporations benefit from weak labor and a beaten-down population. Many are almost too powerful to tame. Walmart generates more money sales in a year than the GDP of Norway. Walmart and like-sized corporations are no longer businesses. They are instead autonomous totalitarian states existing in our own nation. They care only for their own interests, unconcerned with national borders or anything like the public good. Yet, people on the right still vilify the government, and it's baffling, but I totally get it. I was there. I said those words. I was parroting conventional wisdom, the political equivalent of talking about the weather. It's so trite and predictable that it's become a national punchline. Flat tire? Thanks, Obama. Getting fat? Blame Obamacare. Wife left? Damn government! Our national running gag is not only tiresome, but it lacks anything resembling the truth. It's understandable to hate the government because it's easy and it's satisfying. But the government didn't foreclose on your house, cut your paycheck, or send your job to China. Ranting and raving about the government never helped anyone do anything, which brings us back to Senator Sanders. Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist, which is just about as big an American insult as you can get. Conventional politicians and business people decry the evils of socialism except when they are wallowing in it. America has the most generous socialist government that has ever existed in human history, but it only applies to millionaires. If you're on the board of a bank or a massive corporation, the government has unlimited socialism for you. No-cost loans, favorable bankruptcy laws, bailouts and tax breaks without limit. But at the same time, unemployed students cannot discharge student loans no matter how bleak their financial circumstances. Socialism has been inverted. Rather than deployed for the poor and struggling, it's doled out endlessly to people who do not need it. The majority has ceased to rule here. Most people don't even bother to vote, and that is by design. Liberal ideas would always win if everyone voted, which is why there is a nonstop furious attack on the right with respect to voting. America is under siege by a small, insular aristocracy, and they won't go down without a fight. It's telling that we could easily see candidates from only two noble families, the Bushes and the Clintons, in our next election. We need no more perfect example of American feudalism than power being passed back and forth between ruling houses. He describes being on a podcast, much like this one, and he says, on the podcast, I chatted up two fellow liberals who both expressed great support for Sanders, but at the same time, they both insisted he can't possibly win, which taps in to their own deep cynicism. I worry that change cannot happen so long as the angry, mostly white gullible keep protecting their shrinking piece of the pie. I offer only one ray of hope in the form of Shakespearean-level irony, and I have pointed this out on this show before. The fact that the word socialism, nobody knows what it means because it was leveled against President Obama, who's clearly not a socialist, and now the word doesn't have as much stink on it. And he points out the fuming, hate-filled, false rhetoric that has labeled Obama socialist might have actually removed the sting from the insult to the point that it is now meaningless. Even though the idea of socialism is anathema to libertarians, the two groups have a lot in common. On drug law reform, the privacy of private sexual conduct, for instance, that's essentially prostitution. I also know a lot of purist libertarians who are horrified by the xenophobia of Trump. We have our differences, and I've put a lot of effort into criticizing the ideology, but libertarians have much more in common with Sanders than with Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, and other values-pimping theocrats. Bernie Sanders appeared on Kudlow, and he pointed out the ridiculousness of this misunderstood term.
Larry, I'm sure that after all of the ranting and raving that you have done against government intervention and the virtues of the free market, I know without saying that you are opposed to the bailout.
No, I'm in favor of the
bailout. Oh, you've become a socialist overnight,
no,
Larry.
I believe that once every few decades couple times a century, free market guys like me have to attend to financial panic.
See, socialism is okay as long as it helps the super wealthy. So, Larry Kudlow, yes, you too are a socialist, even though you're only okay with it if it's only helping the rich people, if it's only helping Wall Street, if it's only helping the banks. And speaking of libertarian, before I move on to the next part of this subject, Gary Johnson was the nominee for president for the Libertarian Party back during the 2012 election, if I'm not mistaken. And so when the author of the article points out that even libertarians are horrified by the xenophobia of Trump, don't take it from me. Don't take it from the article. take it from one of their nominees himself.
Do you think that Trump represents anything legitimate in the Republican Party or among the American polity?
Well,
he is
appealing to a segment that I'll just label racist, and it exists and it's out there. And you know what? I don't want to have anything to do with it. I don't want to have anything to do with it. It embarrasses me. And like I say, I think that the electorate will paint the entire Republican Party with a broad brush as a result of Trump, and it won't be a positive.
And because he's deported the Mexicans, they'll have to paint their own fence.
He employs tens of thousands of people, and he's in the service industry. How many of those are immigrants? How many of those? I don't get why any of them remain around.
But Melvin, you got to understand, I am socially liberal, and one of the Koch brothers said this. I think it was David. I am socially liberal, but I am economically conservative, and I don't know how you, as a person who describes yourself that way, how you separate those two things.
I would like to say I'm a social liberal and kind of a, I guess, when it comes to financial things, I'm a little bit more conservative.
All right, listen up, dum-dum. There is an article by Greta Christina over at Raw Story, and it says, here are seven things people who say they're fiscally conservative but socially liberal do not understand. You cannot separate fiscal issues from social issues. They are deeply intertwined and they affect each other. Economic issues often are social issues. For example, poverty and the cycle of poverty. Poverty is a social issue. If you're poor, there's about a 2 in 3 chance that you're going to stay poor for at least a year, and about a two in three chance that if you do pull out of poverty, you'll be poor again within 5 years, and about a 2 in 3 chance that your children are going to be poor. And being poor, ironically, is incredibly expensive. You can't buy high quality items that last longer and are therefore a bargain in the long run. You can't buy in bulk. You sure as hell can't buy a house. Depending on where you live, monthly mortgage payments might be lower than the rent that you're paying, but you can't afford the down payment, and chances are a bank won't give you a mortgage anyway. You can't afford the time or money to take care of your health, which means you're more likely to get sick, which is also expensive. If you don't have a bank account, which many poor people don't, you have to pay high fees at check cashing joints. If you run into a temporary cash crisis, you have to borrow from price gouging payday advance places. If your car breaks down and you can't afford to repair or replace it, it can mean unemployment. If you can't afford a car at all, you're severely limited in the jobs that you can take in the first place, a limitation that's even more severe when public transportation is wildly inadequate. I had a job a while back where I had to take the bus to get there, and that worked out fine because when I was working the morning shift, the bus started early enough, would get me to work right on time when I started working. However, when they changed my shift to the nighttime, if I started at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, I didn't get off until 11. And the buses might only run hourly at that point. And if I got off work later than that, I might not have a ride home at all. And I can't just call people at midnight and ask for a ride. So I would try to find ways to start a little earlier and get out a little earlier so that I did not miss the last bus of the night. But not all employers are going to be so gracious to you to allow you to do that. But I had to do what I had to do because I was poor. So what does poverty have? Poverty, fiscal policy, and social policy. What does this have to do with fiscal policy? Poverty is perpetuated or alleviated, worsened, or improved by fiscal policy. Some of the things that have a direct influence are the minimum wage, tax policy, funding of public schools and universities, unionization rights, banking and lending laws, labor laws, funding of public transportation, public health care, unemployment benefits, disability benefits, welfare policy, public assistance that doesn't penalize people for having savings, child care, having a functioning infrastructure, having economic policies that support labor, having a tax system that doesn't steal from the poor to give to the rich, and then having a social safety net, a real safety net. Not just one that barely keeps people from starving to death, but one that actually lets people get on their feet and function. That makes a difference. When these systems are working and working well, it's easier for people to get out of poverty. When they're not, it is impossible. So if you say we should cut the social safety net, but I am socially liberal, you're telling these people to go to hell. Domestic violence. If someone is being beaten by their partner, harassed or assaulted at work, abused by their parents, if they're poor and there's no social safety net, it is a hell of a lot harder for them to leave. What's more, the stress of poverty itself, especially inescapable and trapped poverty, contributes to violence and abuse. Then, of course, there's disenfranchisement.
Voting rights,
yes,
have become a partisan issue. They did not used to be. In my lifetime, they didn't feel like they were for a while, but they are now. Broadly speaking, Democrats are pushing to ease restrictions on voting. Republicans have put new ones in.
It's not easing restrictions. What Democrats are trying to do is make sure that everybody in this country has a right to vote when they're 18 years of age.
But Democrats are losing that fight here in the American system. I understand that.
And let me say something. You know, maybe this is personal because I run for office. You know, sometimes you lose, sometimes you win. It has never occurred to me as a candidate to figure out a way that I could deny the vote to people because they might vote against me. And the people who do that are political cowards. They are afraid of a fair election. We have a real crisis in this country. And we have got to pass legislation, and I'm working, maybe even a constitutional amendment that says that everybody in America who is 18 years of age or older is registered to vote. End of discussion. And what Republicans are doing is so un-American, it is so outrageous, that it is literally beyond belief. They are political cowards, and if they can't face a free election, they should get another job.
Hell yeah, and it doesn't matter whether it's, now, you, a lot of folks, this isn't a real thing, this isn't a real issue. Actually, this is a real issue. And if you are conservative, but socially liberal, but you're economically conservative, then you are for the voter ID laws. You are for, let's see, whether it's purging voter rolls, cutting polling place hours, cutting back on early voting, especially in poor districts, voter ID laws, roadblocks to voter registration, noticeably aimed at people who are more progressive, questionable at best voter fraud detection software. Voter suppression in the United States is a real thing, and it's only perpetuated by conservatives.
You need proof.
Okay. Do you remember Republican House Leader Mark Terzai, who actually said, these are his words, voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done. That's his quote. Oh, come on. Melvin, that's one example. That's one guy. Okay, allow me to indulge, please. Florida Republican Chairman Jim Greer actually said, we're going to cut down on early voting because early voting is not good for us. Need another one? North Carolina Republican Don Yelton actually said that voter restrictions, including voter ID, were going to kick the Democrats in the butt. Let's go to Texas. Republican Attorney General and now Governor Greg Abbott actually said that redistricting decisions were designed to increase the Republican Party's electoral prospects at the expense of Democrats. Need another? Doug Priest, Republican chair of Franklin County, Ohio, which is the second largest county in Ohio, actually said, well, he wrote, in words, that Ohio Republicans were pushing hard to limit early voting because, I guess, this is a quote, I can actually feel we shouldn't contort the process to accommodate the urban African-American voter turnout machine. And those are not my words. Those are his. The African-Americans, to keep the African-Americans from being able to vote. If you are for the conservative policies, although you're socially liberal, well, what about the racist policing practices? Now, this is another thing. They say the Black Lives Movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, it's not a real thing. Racist police, it's not a real thing. According to the article, in cities and counties and towns across the United States, the government is funded in large part by tickets and fines for municipal violations and the meta system of interest, penalties, surcharges, and fees on those tickets and fines, which commonly turn into a never-ending debt amounting to many, many times the original fine itself. There have been a lot of stories in the news lately where somebody without a lot of means will get a ticket for, not stopping fully at a stop sign or speeding, and the original ticket might be, say, $100, $125. But by the time they get down to the courthouse to pay it, all the fees and everything have been stacked on, if they were even able to pay it on time, it is now $430, $470, $500, the original $120. So these departments are targeting the poor, people that do not have money to fund the government. And this works the same with tax policy. They say, let's cut taxes on the wealthy and let's raise them on the poor. Going after the people that do not have money and saying, you know what, they have too much money. Cut their money. And the people that have all the money, they don't have enough money. From the article, this is, for all intents and purposes, a tax. It's a tax on poor people. It's a tax on poor people for being poor and for not having $100 in their bank account that they can drop at a moment's notice on a traffic ticket. And it's a tax that disproportionately targets black and brown people. When the combined deeply ingrained culture of racism in many, 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 many police forces, a police culture that hammers black and brown people for the crime of existing, it's a tax on black and brown people purely for being black or brown. But Loki forbid we raise actual taxes. Remember the fiscal conservative mantra: low tax is good, high tax is bad, high tax is bad, unless we do not call them a tax. What's more, some of the programs that have been proposed to reduce racist policing, programs like automatic video monitoring of police encounters, an independent federal agency to investigate and discipline local policing. These to supplement or replace ineffective, corrupt, or non-existent self-policing. Those things take money. Money that comes from taxes. Money that makes government a little bit bigger. Fiscal conservatism, the reflexive cry of lower taxes, smaller government, contributes to racist policing, even if you personally oppose racist policing. Supporting fiscal conservatism makes you part of the problem. Let's get to drug and prison policy. Four words: the new Jim Crow. Drug war policies in the United States, including sentencing policies, probation policies, which drugs are criminalized and how severely, allow me to point this out. You get more time for crack than you do for cocaine, even though they're essentially the same thing. Why? Because black people are more likely to be involved with crack, and white rich people are more likely to have cocaine. Laws banning felons convicted on drug charges from voting and more have pretty much zero effect on reducing the harm that can be done by drug abuse. They don't reduce drug use. They don't reduce drug addiction. They don't reduce overdoses. They don't reduce accidents or violence that can be triggered by drug abuse. If anything, these policies make all of this worse. But they do, however, have a powerful effect. Current drug policies in the United States are very good at creating a perpetual, permanent black and brown underclass. They're very good at creating a permanent class that is underpaid, disenfranchised, disempowered servants, sentenced to do awful work at low wages for white people for the rest of their lives. And this is not a bug. This is a feature. Plus, two more words: privatized prisons. Privatized prisons means prisons run by people who have no interest in reducing the prison population. People who actually benefit from a high crime rate, a high recidivism rate, severe sentencing policies, severe probation policies, and other treats that keep the prison population high. It's as if we had privatized fire departments who got paid more for the more fires they put out, and thus had an incentive to make sure that there were no fire prevention techniques, policies, or education, and instead gutted policies to make sure that there are more fires. Privatization of prisons is conservative fiscal policy. It's a policy based on the conservative ideal of low taxes, small government, and supposedly miraculous power of the free market to make any system more efficient. And it's a policy with a powerful social effect, the effect of doing tremendous harm. Deregulation. This is a big one, but it's pretty straightforward. Deregulation of business is a conservative fiscal policy, and it has a devastating effect on marginalized people. Need an example? The banking and financial industries that were deregulated. The crash that happened back in 2008. It didn't hurt the people that caused the crash. It hurt the rest of us, the poor and working people, mostly people of color. Deregulation of environmental standards, workplace safety standards, utilities, transportation, media, all of these have the entirely unsurprising effect of making things better for the people who own businesses and worse for the people who patronize them or work for them. Contrary to the fiscal conservative myth, an unregulated free market does not result in exceptional business, fiercely competing for the best workers and lavishly serving the public. It results in monopoly. It results in businesses with the unofficial slogan, "We don't care, we don't have to." And then this brings us to point seven, free trade. So-called free trade policies have a horrible effect on human rights, both in the United States and overseas. They let corporations hire labor in countries where labor laws, laws about minimum wage, workplace safety, working hours, child labor are weak or non-existent. They let corporations hire labor in countries where they can pay children as young as 5 years old less than a dollar a day to work 12 or even 16 hours a day in grossly unsafe workplaces and grueling working conditions that make Dickensian London look like a socialist utopia. And again, this is not a bug. This is the feature. This is the intended outcome. So look, there are conservatives who will insist that this isn't what fiscally conservative means. They're not inherently opposed to government spending, they'll say. They're just opposed to ineffective, wasteful government spending, la-da-da-da-da. Do they really think that progressives are in favor of wasteful spending and ineffective government? Do they think that we're saying thumbs up to ineffective government spending? The reality means decimating government regulations, even when they've been shown to improve people's lives. The reality means cutting the safety net to ribbons and letting big businesses do whatever the hell they want. We need to support economic policies that make marginalized people's lives better. You need to oppose economic policies that perpetuate human rights abuses and make marginalized people's lives awful. And that means not being a fiscal conservative.
I know that people are demoralized. Despair is not an option because it's not just for us, but it's for our kids and our grandchildren.
And that's the larger point. And we need to kill the talking point about how awful Hillary is, or how terrible, bad, no good, how she's got all these ghosts and skeletons in the closet and all the rest. And we need to stop talking ourselves out of having Sanders as our nominee. These are both great candidates. And you can pick one or the other. But ultimately, in November, we need to all come together behind whatever progressive candidate gets it. And this doesn't mean that you get to throw a tantrum and stay home and pretend that this isn't important and pretend that this is too big a thing, to pretend that this is a thing that we cannot do together, to pretend that this is not worth your time, that if your candidate does not make it, then by God, you may as well just stay home and cross your arms and look at the floor and grit your teeth and don't get to act like a baby, because we all suffer when we don't all get involved. And these policies affect every one of us. Every one of us that is working, every one of us that is a working person, every one of us that is poor. It affects us. And you're handing power over when you reduce it to dumb infighting, when you reduce it to name calling, when you reduce it to throwing attention because your guy didn't get it. They're both great. Bernie backer, but I'm going to vote for Hillary if she makes it to the general. Because I can't have any more of these conservative policies. They're not serving anybody. Not serving me, not serving anybody I know. They're hurting the country. And they're starving and they're killing. And it's giving us a disastrous foreign policy. Let's be grown-ups and walk into this year's election with our heads held high, knowing that we have worthy, good candidates. And that if we work together, we can do this. Remember, despair is not an option.
I know that people are demoralized. Despair is not an option because it's not just for us, but it's for our kids and our grandchildren.
Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. You can download or stream the shows at openskyarchive.com. Our official home is kiwistation.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TFYCPO. You can listen on the go. Just download the Kiwi Station app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. The Open Sky archive app is still available at both app stores. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, my name is Melvin. You can hate me at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base, so feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing an epic things, the TV station putting us on, making us available 24/7, 365 around the world. This is Melvin signing off, and now that I have woken you up, good morning.